Speaker smiled and said, "We had a civilization, too." The puppeteer was a silent ghostly image, a one-eyed python poised to strike. Presumably the other mouth was steering his cycle, which by now was a good distance away. "The puppeteers used us," said Louis Wu. "They used us as a tool to evolve the Kzinti." "But it worked," Teela insisted. The sound was almost a snore, a low and ominous snarl. By now nobody could have mistaken Speaker's expression for a smile. "It did work," Teela flared. "You're a peaceful race now, Speaker. You can get along with—"
"Be silent, man."
"With your equals," she finished generously. "You haven't attacked another species in—" The Kazin produced the modified slaver digging tool and held it before the intercom so that Teela could see it. She stopped talking suddenly. "It could have been us," said Louis. He had their attention. "It could have been us," he repeated. "If the puppeteers had wanted to breed humans for some trait—" He stopped. "Oh," he said. "Teela. Sure." The puppeteer did not react. Teela shifted under Louis's stare. "What's the matter, Louis?" "Louis!" "Sorry, something just occurred to me. Nessus, speak to us. Speak to us of the fertility laws."
"Louis, have you gone crazy?"
"Urgh," said Speaker to animals. "I would have thought of that myself, given time. Nessus?"
"Yes," said Nessus.
The puppeteer's cycle was a silver mote, still dwindling to port. It was almost lost against a larger, vaguer, bright point ahead, somewhat more distant from the fleet than any two points can be on Earth. The puppeteer's intercom image wore the unchanging, unreadable, silly face produced by a flat triangular skull and loose, prehensile lips. He could not look dangerous, this one. "You meddled with the fertility laws of Earth."
"Yes."
"Why?"
"We like humans. We trust humans. We have dealt profitably with humans. It is to our advantage to encourage humans, since they will certainly reach the lesser cloud before we do."
"Wonderful. You like us, so?"
"We sought to improve you genetically, but what should we improve? Not your intelligence. Intelligence is not your great strength, nor is your sense of self-preservation, nor your durability, nor your fighting talents."
"So you decided to make us lucky," said Louis. And he began to laugh.
Teela got it then. Her eyes went round and horrified. She tried to say something, but it came out as a squeak.
"Of course," said Nessus. "Please stop laughing, Louis. The decision was sensible. Your species has been incredibly lucky. Your history reads like a series of hairbreadth escapes, from intraspecies atomic war, from pollution of your planet with industrial wastes, from ecological upsets, from dangerously massive asteroids, from the vagaries of your mildly variable sun, and even from the core explosion, which you discovered only by the merest accident. Louis, why are you still laughing?"
Louis was still laughing because he was looking at Teela. Teela was blushing furiously. Her eyes shifted as if seeking a place to hide. It is not pleasant to realize that one is part of a genetics experiment.
"And so we changed the fertility laws of Earth. It was surprisingly easy. Our withdrawal from known space caused a stock market crash. Economic manipulation ruined several members of the fertility board. We bribed some of these, blackmailed others with the threat of debtor's prison, then used corruption in the fertility board as publicity to force a change. It was a hideously expensive undertaking, but quite safe and partially successful. We were able to introduce the birthright lotteries. We hoped to produce a strain of unusually lucky humans."
"Monster!" Teela shouted. "Monster!"
Speaker had sheathed his slaver digging tool. He said,
"Teela, you did not complain when you learned that the puppeteers had manipulated the heredity of my race. They sought to produce a docile Kazin. To that end, they bred us as a biologist breeds steets, killing the defectives, keeping others. You gloated that this crime was to the benefit of your species. Now you complain. Why?" Teela, weeping with rage, cut herself out of the intercom.
A docile Kazin, Speaker repeated. You sought to produce a docile Kazin, Nessus. If you think you have produced a docile Kazin, come and rejoin us.
The puppeteer did not answer. Somewhere far ahead of the fleet, the silver point of his cycle had become too small to see.
You do not wish to rejoin our fleet? But how can I protect you from this unknown land unless you rejoin the fleet? But I do not blame you. You do well to be wary, said the Kazin.
His claws were showing, needle-sharp and slightly curved.
Your attempt to produce a lucky human was also a failure.
No, said Nessus, via intercom. We produced lucky humans. I could not contact them for this ill-fated expedition. They were too lucky.
You have played God with both our species. Do not attempt to rejoin us.
I will remain in intercom contact.
Speaker's image disappeared.
Louis, Speaker has cut me off, said Nessus. If I have something to tell him, I must pass it through you.
Fine, said Louis, and cut him off. Almost instantly, a tiny light burned where the puppeteer's ghost head had been. The puppeteer wanted to talk.
Tanj upon him.
Later that day, they crossed a sea the size of the Mediterranean. Louis dipped to investigate, and found that the other cycles followed him down. The fleet, then, was still under his guidance, despite the fact that nobody would speak to him. The shoreline was a single city, and the city was a ruin. Aside from the docks, it did not differ in kind from Zignamu Click-Click. Louis did not land. There was nothing to be learned here. Afterward, the land sloped gradually upward, always upward, until ears popped and pressure sensors dropped. The green land became brown scrub, then high desert tundra, then miles and miles of bare rock, then... Along half a thousand miles of Ridgeback Mountain Peak, the winds had scraped away scrub and soil and rock. Nothing was left but an exposed backbone of ring foundation material, translucent gray and hideous.
Sloppy upkeep.
No Ringworld engineer would have permitted such a thing. The Ringworld civilization, then, must have begun to die long ago. The process would have started here, with bare spots poking through the facade in the places where nobody went. Far ahead of the fleet, in the direction Nessus had gone, was an extensive shiny spot in the landscape. At a guess, it was 30 to 50,000 miles away. A great shiny spot as big as Australia. More exposed ring floor? Vast shiny areas of ring foundation poking through once fertile soil, soil that dies and dries and blows away when the river systems break down. The fall of Zignamu Click-Click, the universal power failure, must have been the last stage of the breakdown. How long had it taken? 10,000 years? Longer?
Tanjit, I wish I could talk it over with someone. It might be important.
Louis scowled at the landscape. Time was different when the sun was always straight overhead. Morning and afternoon were identical. Decisions seemed less than permanent. Reality seemed less than real. It was, Louis thought, like the instant of time spent traveling between transfer booths. That was it. They were between transfer booths, one at the Lyre, one at the rim wall. They only dreamed that they flew above flat gray land in a triangle pattern of fly cycles. They flew to port through frozen time. How long had it been since anyone had spoken to anyone? It had been hours since Louis had signaled Teela that he wanted to talk to her. Not much later he had signaled Speaker. Lights had burned above their dashboards, ignored, as Louis ignored the light above his own.
Enough of that, Louis said suddenly.
He opened his intercom. He caught an incredible burst of orchestral music before the puppeteer noticed him. Then,
we must see to it that the expedition is reunited without bloodshed, said Nessus. Have you any suggestions, Louis?
Yes, it's not polite to start a conversation in the middle.
I apologize, Louis. Thank you for returning my call. How have you been?
Lonely and irritated, and it's all your fault. Nobody wants to talk to me.
Can I help?
Maybe. Did you have anything to do with changing the fertility laws?
I headed the project.
Louis snorted. That's the wrong answer. May you be the first victim of retroactive birth control. Teela won't ever speak to me again.
You should not have laughed at her.
I know. You know what scares me the most about this whole thing? Not your there-ain't-no-justice arrogance, said Louis. It's the fact that you can make decisions of that magnitude, then do something as downright stupid as...
Can Teela Brown hear us?
No, of course not. Tanju Nessus, do you know what you've done to her?
If you knew her ego would be so wounded, why did you speak?
Louis moaned. He had solved a thought problem and immediately revealed the solution. It had not occurred to him, it would never have occurred to him, that the solution was better hidden. He didn't think that way. The puppeteer asked,
Have you thought of a way to reunite the expedition?
Yes, said Louis, and he switched off. Let the puppeteer sweat over that one. The land sloped down and became green again. They passed another sea and a great triangular river delta. But the riverbed was dry, and so was the delta. Alterations in the wind currents must have dried up the source. As Louis dipped low, it became clear that all of the haphazard meandering channels that made up the delta had been carved permanently into the land. The Ringworld artists had not been content to let the river dig its own channels, and they had been right. The soil wasn't deep enough on the Ringworld. Artifice was necessary. But the empty channels were ugly. Louis pursed his lips in disapproval and flew on. Chapter 14. Interlude with Sunflowers. Not far ahead, there were mountains. Louis had flown all night and well into the morning. He wasn't sure how long. The motionless noon sun was a psychological trap. It either compressed or stretched time, and Louis wasn't sure which. Emotionally, Louis was on sabbatical. He had almost forgotten the other fly cycles. Flying alone over unending, endlessly changing terrain was no different from ranging alone in a single ship beyond the known stars. Louis Wu was alone with the universe, and the universe was a plaything for Louis Wu. The most important question in the universe became, is Louis Wu still satisfied with himself? It came as a shock when a furry orange face formed above the dash.
You must be tiring, said the Kazin. Do you wish me to fly?
I'd rather land. I'm getting cramped.
Land, then. The controls are yours.
I don't want to force my company on anyone. As he said it, Louis realized that he meant it. The sabbatical mood had been too easily recaptured.
Do you feel that Teela would avoid you? You may be right. She has not even called me, though I share her shame.
You're taking it too hard. No, wait, don't switch off.
I wish to be alone, Louis. The leaf-eater has shamed me terribly.
But it was so long ago. No, don't switch off. Have pity on a lonely old man. Have you been watching the landscape?
Yes.
Did you notice the bare regions?
Yes. In places, erosion has cut through bedrock to the indestructible ring floor. Something must have badly upset the wind patterns a very long time ago. Such erosion cannot happen overnight, even on the Ringworld.
Right.
Louis, how could a civilization of such size and power fall?
I don't know. Let's face it, there's no way to guess, not for us. Even the puppeteers never reached the Ringworld's level of technology. How can we tell what might have knocked them back to the fist axe level?
We must learn more about the natives, said Speaker to Animals. Our evidence thus far indicates that they could not possibly move the ruined lyre anywhere. We must find those who can.
It was the opening Louis had hoped for. I have some ideas on that score, an effective way to contact the natives as often as we like.
Well?
I'd like to land before we talk it over.
Land, then.
Mountains formed a high, blocky range across the path of the flycycle fleet.
Their peaks and the passes between glowed with a pearly sheen Louis recognized. Winds roaring over and between the peaks had polished away the rock, exposing the framework of ring floor material. Louis dropped the fleet toward gently rounded foothills. His target was the mouth of a silver stream that poured out of the mountains and disappeared into a forest, itself seemingly endless, that covered the foothills like green fur. Teela called.
"What are you doing?" she demanded.
"I'm landing. I'm tired of flying. But don't hang up. I'd like to apologize." She switched off.
"Best I could hope for," Louis told himself without conviction. But she would be more willing to listen now that she knew an apology was coming.
"I got the idea from all our talk about playing God," said Louis. Unfortunately, he was talking only to Speaker. Teela had dismounted her cycle, thrown him one smoking glare, and stalked off into the woods. Speaker nodded his shaggy orange head. His ears twitched like small Chinese fans held in nervous fingers.
"We're reasonably safe in this world," Louis told him, "as long as we're in the air. There's no question but that we can get where we're going. We could probably reach the rim wall without ever landing, if it came to that. Or we could land only where the ring foundation pokes through. No predatory life could survive on that stuff."
"But we can't learn much without landing. We want to get off this oversized toy, and to do that we're going to need native help. It still looks as though someone is going to have to haul the lyre across 4,000 miles of landscape."
"Get to the point, Louis. I need exercise."
"By the time we reach the rim wall, we'll want to know a lot more about the ringworlders than we do now."
"Unquestionably."
"Why not play God?"
Speaker hesitated.
"You speak with literal precision?"
"Right. We're naturals for ringworld engineers. We don't have the powers they had, but what we do have must look godlike enough to the natives.
You can be the god."
"Thank you."
"Teela and I the acolytes. Nessus would make a good captive demon."
Speaker's claws came out. He said, "But Nessus is not with us and will not be."
"That's the hitch.
This is not open to argument, Louis."
"Too bad. We need him to make this work."
"Then you must forget it."
Louis was still in doubt about those claws. Were they or were they not under voluntary control? In any case, they were still showing. Had he been speaking over intercom, Speaker would certainly have switched off by now. Which was why Louis had insisted on landing.
"Look at the sheer intellectual beauty of it. You'd make a great god.
From a human viewpoint, you're impressive as all hell, though I suppose you'd have to take my word for that."
"Why would we need Nessus?"
"For the TASP. For reward and punishment. As a god, you tear a doubter to shreds and gobbets, then eat the gobbets. That's punishment. For reward, you use the puppeteer's TASP."
"Can we not do without the TASP?"
"But it's such a great way to reward the faithful. A blast of pure pleasure, straight to the brain. No side effects, no hangover. A TASP is supposed to be better than sex."
"I do not like the ethics. Though the natives are only human, I would not like to addict them to a TASP. It would be more merciful to kill them," said Speaker. "In any case, the puppeteer's TASP works against Kazinti, not human."
"I think you're wrong."
"Louis, we know that the TASP was designed for use against a Kazinti brain structure. I felt it. In this you are right. It was a religious experience, a diabolical experience."
"But we don't know the TASP doesn't work on a human being. I think it does. I know Nessus. Either his TASP works on both of us, or he's carrying two TASPs. I wouldn't be here unless he had a way to control humans."
"You speculate wildly."
"Shall we call him and ask him?"
"No."
"What's the harm in asking him?"
"There would be no purpose in it."
"I forgot. No curiosity," said Louis. Monkey curiosity was not powerful in most sentient species.
"Were you playing on my curiosity?"
"I see. You tried to commit me to a course of action."
"Louis, the puppeteer may find his own way to the rim wall. Until then, he travels alone."
And before Louis could answer, the Kazin turned and bounded into a thicket of elbow root. It ended the discussion as effectively as if he had switched off an intercom.
The world had caved in on Teela Brown. She sobbed miserably, rackingly, in an orgy of self-pity. She had found a wonderful place for her mourning. Dark green was the motif. The vegetation was lush overhead, too thick to permit the direct passage of sunlight. But it thinned out near the ground, to make walking easy. It was a somber paradise for nature lovers. Flat, vertical rock walls, kept constantly wet by a waterfall, surrounded a deep, clear pool. Teela was in the pool. The falling water nearly drowned out her sobbing, but the rock walls amplified the sound like a shower stall. It was as if nature wept with her. She had not noticed Louis Wu. Stranded on an alien world, even Teela Brown would not have gone far without her first aid kit. It was a small flat box on her belt, and it had a finder circuit built into it. Louis had followed its signal to Teela's clothes, which were piled on a natural granite tabletop at the pool's edge. Dark green illumination, the roar of a waterfall, and the echoed sound of sobbing. Teela was almost under the falling water. She must be sitting on something, for her arms and shoulders were out of the pool. Her head was bent, and her dark hair streamed forward to cover her face. There was no point in waiting for her to come to him. Louis took off his clothes, piled them beside Teela's. He frowned at the chill in the air, shrugged, and dove in. He saw his mistake instantly. On sabbatical, Louis did not commonly run across Earth-like worlds. Those he did land on were generally as civilized as Earth itself. Louis was not stupid. If it had occurred to him to wonder about the temperature of the water... But it didn't. The water was runoff water from snow-capped mountains. Louis tried to scream with the cold, but his head was already underwater. He did have sense enough not to inhale. His head broke water. He splashed and gasped with the cold and the need for air. Then he began to enjoy it. He knew how to tread water, though he had learned in warmer waters than these. He stayed afloat, kicking rhythmically, feeling the currents from the plunging waterfall eddy over his skin. Teela had seen him. She sat beneath the waterfall, waiting. He swam to her. He would have had to scream into her face to tell her anything. Apologies and words of love would have been misplaced. But he could touch her. She did not flinch away, but she bent her head, and her hair hid her again. Her rejection was almost telepathically intense. Louis respected it. He swam about, stretching muscles cramped by 18 hours in a fly-cycle seat. The water felt wonderful. But at some point the numbness of the cold became an ache, and Louis decided he was courting pneumonia. He touched Teela on the arm and pointed toward shore. This time she nodded and followed. They lay beside the pool, shivering, wrapped in each other's arms, with the thermo-controlled coveralls open and spread around them like blankets. Gradually their chilled bodies soaked up the heat. "I'm sorry I laughed," Louis said. She nodded, accepting the fact of his apology, without forgiveness. "It was funny, you know. The puppeteers, the cowards of the universe, having the gall to breed humans in Kazinti like two strains of cattle. They must have known what a chance they were taking." He knew he was talking too much, but he had to explain, to justify himself. "And then look what they did with it. Breeding for a reasonable Kazin, that wasn't a bad idea. I know a little about the Man-Kazin Wars. I know the Kazinti used to be pretty fierce. Speaker's ancestors would have blasted Zignamu Click-Click down to the ring floor. Speaker stopped. But breeding humans for luck...
You think they made a mistake making me what I am?
Tanjit, do you think I'm trying to insult you? I'm trying to say that it's a funny idea. For puppeteers to do it is even funnier, so I laughed."
"Do you expect me to giggle?"
"That'd be going too far."
"All right."
She didn't hate him for laughing. She wanted comfort, not revenge. There was comfort in the heat of the coveralls, and comfort in the heat of two bodies pressed together. Louis began to stroke Teela's back. It made her relax. "I'd like to get the expedition back together again," he said presently. He felt her stiffen. "You don't like that idea?"
"No."
"Nessus?"
"I hate him, I hate him! He bred my ancestors like beasts."
She relaxed minutely.
But Speaker would blast him out of the sky if he tried to come back, so it's all right.
Suppose I could talk Speaker into letting Nessus rejoin us.
How could you do that?
Suppose I could.
But why?
Nessus still owns the long shot. The long shot is the only way to get the human race to the clouds of Magellan in less than centuries. We lose the long shot if we leave the ring world without Nessus.
How crass, Louis.
Look, you claimed that if the puppeteers hadn't done what they did to the Kzinti, we'd all be Kzinti slaves.
True.
But if the puppeteers hadn't interfered with the fertility laws, you wouldn't even have been born. She was rigid against him. Her mind showed in her face, and her face was like her eyes, tightly closed. He kept trying. What the puppeteers did, they did a long time ago. Can't you forgive and forget?
No.
She rolled away from him, out from under the heated coveralls and into the icy water. Louis hesitated, then followed her. A cold, wet shock. He surfaced. Tila was back at her place beneath the waterfall. Smiling an invitation. How could her moods change so suddenly? He swam to her.
That's a charming way to tell a man to shut up, he laughed.
She couldn't possibly have heard him. He couldn't hear himself with the water pounding down around them. But Tila laughed back, equally soundlessly, and reached for him.
They were stupid arguments anyway, he screamed.
The water was cold, cold. Tila was the only warmth. They knelt, clasping each other, supported by rough, shallow, underwater rock. Love was a delicious blend of warm and cold. There was comfort in making love. It solved no problems, but one could run away from problems. They walked back toward the cycles, shivering a little within their heated cocoons. Louis didn't speak. He had realized a thing about Tila Brown. She had never learned how to reject. She could not say no and make it stick. She could not deliver reproofs of calculated intensity, humorous or jabbing or deadly vicious, as other women could. Tila Brown had not been hurt socially, not often enough to learn these things. Louis could browbeat her until doomsday, and she would not know how to stop him. But she could hate him for it, and so he remained silent, for that reason and for another. He didn't want to hurt her. They walked in silence, holding hands, making love play with their fingers.
All right, she said suddenly. If you can talk Speaker into it, you can bring Nessus back.
Thanks, said Louis. He showed his surprise.
It's only for the long shot, she said. Besides, you can't do it.
There was time for a meal and for formal exercises, push-ups and sit-ups, and for informal exercises, tree climbing. Presently, Speaker returned to the cycles. His mouth was not bloody. At his cycle he dialed, not for an allergy pill, but for a wet, brick-shaped slab of warm liver. The mighty hunter returns, Louis thought, keeping his mouth firmly shut. The sky had been overcast when they landed. It was still overcast, a uniform leaden gray as they took off. And Louis resumed his argument by intercom.
But it was so long ago.
A point of honor is not affected by time, Louis, though of course you would not know that. Further, the consequences of the act are very much with us. Why did Nessus select a Kazin to travel with him?
He told us that.
Why did he select Tila Brown? The hindmost must have instructed Nessus to learn if humans have inherited psychic luck. He was also to learn if Kzinti had become docile. He chose me because as ambassador to a characteristically arrogant species, I am likely to demonstrate the docility his people seek.
I thought of that, too.
Louis had carried the idea even further. Had Nessus been instructed to mention starseed lures in order to gauge Speaker's reactions?
It matters not. I say that I am not docile.
Will you stop using that word? It warps your thinking.
Louis, why do you intercede for the puppeteer? Why do you wish his company?
Good questions, Louis thought. Certainly the puppeteer deserved to sweat a little, and if what Louis suspected was true, Nessus was in no danger at all. Was it only that Louis Wu liked aliens?
Or was it more general than that? A puppeteer was different. Difference was important. A man of Louis Wu's age would get bored with life itself without variety. To Louis, the company of aliens was a vital necessity. The cycles rose, following the slope of the mountains.
"Viewpoints," said Louis Wu. "We're in a strange environment, stranger than any world of men or Kazinti. We may need all the insights we can bring to bear just to figure out what's going on."
Tila applauded without sound. "Nicely argued." Louis winked back. A very human conversation. Speaker couldn't possibly read its meaning. The Kazin was saying,
"I do not need a puppeteer to explain the world to me. My own eyes, nose, and ears are sufficient."
"That's moot, but you do need the long shot. We all need the techniques that ship represents."
"For profit, an unworthy motive."
"Tanjit, that's not fair. The long shot is for the entire human race, and the Kazinti, too."
"A quibble, though the profit is not to you alone. Still, you sell your honor for profit."
"My honor is not in danger," Louis grated.
"I think it is," said Speaker, and he switched off.
"That's a handy little gadget, that switch," Tila observed without malice. "I knew he'd do that."
"So did I, but Lord Finnegal, he's hard to convince."
Beyond the mountains was an endless expanse of fleecy cloud, graying out at the infinity horizon. The flycycles seemed to float above white cloud, beneath a bright blue sky in which the arch was an outline at the threshold of visibility. The mountains fell behind. Louis felt a twinge of regret for the forest pool with the waterfall. They would never see it again. A wake followed the cycles, a roiling wave front where three sonic booms touched the cloud cover. Ahead, only one detail broke the infinity horizon. Louis decided that it was either a mountain or a storm, very distant, very large. It was the size of a pinhead held at arm's length. Speaker broke the silence.
"A rift in the cloud cover, Louis. Ahead and to spinward."
"I see it."
"Do you see how the light shines through? Much light is being reflected from the landscape."
"True, the edges of the cloud break glowed brightly. Hmm. Could we be flying over Ringworld Foundation material? It would be the biggest break yet in the landscape."
"I want to look more closely."
"Good," said Louis. He watched the speck that was Speaker's flycycle curve frantically away to spinward. At Mach 2, Speaker would get no more than a glimpse of the ground. There was a problem here. Which to watch? The silver fleck that was Speaker's flycycle, or the small orange cat face above the dash? One was real, one was detailed. Both offered information, but of different kinds. In principle, no answer was entirely satisfactory. In practice, Louis naturally watched both. He saw that Speaker was over the rift. The intercom echoed Speaker's yowl. The silver fleck had gone suddenly brighter, and Speaker's face was a glare of white light. His eyes were closed tight. His mouth was open, screaming. The image dimmed. Speaker had crossed the rift. One arm was thrown across his face. The fur that covered him was smoking black char. Beneath the diverging silver speck of Speaker's flycycle, a bright spot showed on the cloud cover, as if a spotlight followed Speaker from below.
"Speaker," Tila called, "can you see?"
Speaker heard and uncovered his face. The orange fur was unburned in a broad band across his eyes. Elsewhere, the fur was ash black. Speaker opened his eyes, closed them tight, opened them again.
"I'm blind," he said.
"Yes, but can you see?"
In his worry over Speaker, Louis hardly noticed the strangeness of that question, but something in him noted her tone of voice, the anxiety, and beneath that, the suggestion that Speaker had given a wrong answer and should be given a second chance. But there wasn't time. Louis called, "Speaker, slave your cycle to mine. We've got to get to cover." Speaker fumbled at the board.
"Done. Louis, what kind of cover?"
Pain thickened and distorted his voice.
"Back to the mountains." "No, we would lose too much time. Louis, I know what attacked me. If I am right, then we are safe as long as we have cloud cover."
"Oh?"
"You will have to investigate."
"You need medical attention."
"I do indeed. But first you must find us a safe place to land. You must descend where the clouds are most dense."
It was not dark down here below the clouds. Some light came through, enough of what was reflected toward Louis Wu. It glared. The land was an undulating plain. It was not ring floor material, but soil and vegetation. Louis dropped lower, squinting against the glare. A single species of plant, evenly dispersed across the land from here to the infinity horizon. Each plant had a single blossom, and each blossom turned to follow Louis Wu as he dropped. A tremendous audience, silent and attentive. He landed and dismounted beside one of the plants. The plant stood a foot high, on a knobbly green stalk. Its single blossom was as big as a large man's face. The back of that blossom was stringy, as if laced with veins or tendons, and the inner surface was a smooth concave mirror. From its center protruded a short stalk ending in a dark green bulb. All the flowers in sight watched him. He was bathed in the glare. Louis knew they were trying to kill him, and he looked up somewhat uneasily, but the cloud cover held. "You were right," he said, speaking into the intercom. "They're slaver sunflowers. If the cloud cover hadn't come up, we'd have been dead the instant we rose over the mountains."
"Is there a cover where we can hide from the sunflowers? A cave, for example?"
"I don't think so. The land's too flat. The sunflowers can't focus the light with any precision, but there's a lot of glare anyway." Teela broke in. "For pity's sake, what's the matter with you two? Louis, we've got to land. Speaker's in pain."
"Truly, I am in pain, Louis."
"Then I vote we risk it. Come down, you two. We'll just have to hope the clouds hold."
"Good."
Teela's intercom image went into action. Louis spent a minute or so searching between the plants. It was as he had surmised. There was no alien survivor anywhere in the domain of the sunflowers. No smaller plant grew between the stalks. Nothing flew. Nothing burrowed beneath the ashy-looking soil. On the plants themselves, there were no blights, fungus growths, disease spots. If disease struck one of their own, the sunflowers would destroy it. The mirror blossom was a terrible weapon. Its primary purpose was to focus sunlight on the green photosynthetic node at its center. But it could also focus to destroy a plant-eating animal or insect. The sunflowers burned all enemies. Everything that lives is the enemy of a photosynthesis-using plant, and everything that lived became fertilizer for the sunflowers.
"But how did they come here?" Louis wondered.
For sunflowers could not coexist with less exotic plant life. Sunflowers were too powerful. Thus, they could not be native to the Ringworlder's original planet. The engineers must have scouted nearby stars for their useful or decorative plants. Perhaps they had even come as far as Silver Eyes in human space. And they must have decided that the sunflowers were decorative.
But they would have fenced them in. Any idiot would have that much sense. Give them, say, a plot of ground with a high broad ring of bare ring flooring around it. That would keep them in.
Only it didn't. Somehow a seed got across. No telling how far they've spread by now, said Louis to himself. And he shuddered. This must be the bright spot he and Nessus had noticed ahead of them. As far as the eye could see, no living thing challenged the sunflowers. In time, if they were given time, the sunflowers would rule the ring world. But that would take much time. The ring world was roomy. Roomy enough for anything.
Chapter 15. Dream Castle.
Louis, musing, was only half aware of two fly cycles dropping beside his own. He was jerked from his reverie when Speaker barked,
"Louis, you will take the slaver disintegrator from my cycle and use it to dig us a hiding hole. Teela, come and tend my injuries."
"A hiding hole?"
"Yes, we must burrow like animals and wait for nightfall."
"Yeah." Louis shook himself. Speaker should not have had to think of that, injured as he was. Obviously, they could not risk a break in the clouds. All the sunflowers needed to murder them was a point source of light. But at night... Louis avoided looking at Speaker while he searched Speaker's cycle. One look had been enough. The Kazin was burnt black across most of his body. Fluids leaked through the oily ash that had been fur. Flesh showed bright red in wide cracks. The smell of burnt hair was strong and terrible. Louis found the disintegrator, a double-barreled shotgun with a fluid-seeming handle. The weapon next to it made him grin sourly. If Speaker had suggested burning off the sunflowers with flashlight lasers, Louis probably would have gone along with it, fuddled as he was. He took the weapon and withdrew quickly, feeling queasy, ashamed of his weakness. He hurt with the pain of Speaker's burns. Tila, who knew nothing of pain, could help Speaker better than Louis could. Louis aimed the gun 30 degrees downward. He was wearing the breathing helmet from his pressure suit. As he was in no hurry, he flipped only one of the two triggers. The pit formed fast. Louis couldn't see how fast, for the dust was all around him after the first instant. A minor hurricane blew at him from where the beam fell. Louis had to lean hard into the wind. In the cone of the beam, the electron became a neutral particle. Soil and rock, torn to atoms by the mutual repulsion of the nuclei, reached him as a fog of monatomic dust. Louis was glad of the breathing helmet. Presently, he turned off the disintegrator. The pit looked big enough to fit the three of them and the fly cycles, too. So quickly, he thought. And he wondered how fast the tool would dig with both beams on. But then there would be a current flow, he thought, borrowing Speaker's euphemism. At the moment, he wasn't looking for that much excitement. Tila and Speaker had dismounted. Speaker was now hairless over most of his body. A large orange patch still covered him where he sat, and a broad orange band crossed his eyes. Elsewhere, his nude skin was veined red-violet, showing clusters of deep red cracks. Tila was spraying him with something that foamed white where it touched. The stench of burnt hair and meat stayed Louis from coming too close. "It's done," he said. The Kazin looked up.
"I can see again, Louis."
"Good." He'd been worried.
"The puppeteer brought military medical supplies, vastly superior to Kazinti civilian medicines. He should not have had access to military supplies."
The Kazin sounded angry. Perhaps he suspected bribery, and perhaps he was right. "I'm going to call Nessus," Louis said, and he circled the pair. White foam now covered the Kazin from head to foot. There was no smell at all.
"I know where you are," he told the puppeteer.
"Marvelous. Where am I, Louis?"
"You're behind us. You circled round behind us as soon as you were out of sight. Tila and Speaker don't know. They can't think like puppeteers."
"Do they expect a puppeteer to break trail for them?" "Perhaps it is best they continue to think so. What chance is there that they will permit me to rejoin them?"
"Not now, maybe later. Let me tell you why I called."
And he told the puppeteer about the sunflower field. He was detailing the extent of Speaker's injuries when Nessus's flat face dropped below the level of the intercom camera. Louis waited a few moments for the puppeteer to reappear, then he switched off. He was sure that Nessus would not remain long in catatonic withdrawal. The puppeteer was too sanely careful of his own life. 10 hours of daylight remained. The team waited it out in the disintegrator-dug trench. Speaker slept through it. They walked him into the trench, then used a spray from the Kazinti medkit to put him to sleep. The white foam had congealed on him to the consistency of a foam rubber pillow.
"The world's only bouncy Kazin," said Tila.
Louis tried to sleep. He dozed for a time. Once he half woke to bright daylight and to the sharp black shadow of the slope falling across him. He stirred and went back to sleep. And woke later in a cold sweat. Shadows. If he had sat up to look, he'd have been burnt crisp. But the clouds were back, safely blocking the vengeance of the sunflowers. Finally, one horizon dimmed. As the sky darkened, Louis set about waking the others. They flew beneath the clouds. It was vital that they be able to see the sunflowers. If dawn approached while the fleet was still over sunflowers,
They would have to hide out during the next day. Occasionally, Louis dipped his cycle for a closer look. For an hour they flew, and then the sunflowers grew sparse. There was a region where sunflowers were scarce, half-grown seedlings growing among the blackened stumps of a recently burned forest. Grass actually seemed to compete with the sunflowers in this area. Then there were no sunflowers at all, and Louis could sleep at last. Louis slept as if drugged. It was still night when he woke. He looked about him and found a glimmer of light ahead and to spinward. Groggy as he was, he thought it would turn out to be a firefly caught in the sonic fold, or something equally silly. But it was still there after he rubbed his eyes. He pushed the call button for speaker. The light grew nearer and clearer. Against the darkness of the ringworld night landscape, it showed bright as a point of reflected sunlight. Not a sunflower, not at night. It might be a house, Louis thought. But where would a native get his lighting? Then again, a house would have gone by like that. At flycycle cruising speed, you could cross the North American continent in 2.5 hours. The light was drifting past them on the right, and still Speaker hadn't answered. Louis cut his cycle out of formation. He was grinning in the dark. Behind him, the fleet, now under Speaker's guidance, at Speaker's insistence, was only 2 cycles strong. Louis picked Speaker's from memory. He flew toward it. Shockwaves and sonic fold showed faintly outlined by cloud-dimmed archlight, a network of straight lines converging to a point. Speaker's flycycle and Speaker's ghost-gray silhouette seemed caught in a Euclidean spiderweb. Louis was perilously close when he turned his spotlight on and immediately off. In the dark, he saw the ghost come suddenly alert. Louis guided his cycle carefully between the Kazin and the point of light. He blinked his spotlight again. Speaker came on the intercom.
"Yes, Louis, I see it now. A lighted something going past us."
"Then let's look it over."
"Very well."
Speaker turned toward the light. They circled it in the dark, like curious minnows nosing a sinking beer bottle. It was a 10-story castle floating 1,000 feet high, and it was all lit up like the instrument board on some ancient rocket ship. A single tremendous picture window, curved so that it formed both wall and ceiling, opened on a cavity the size of an opera house. Within, a labyrinth of dining tables surrounded a raised circle of floor. There was 50 feet of space above the tables, empty but for a free-form sculpture in stressed wire. Always it came as a fresh surprise, the elbow room on the Ringworld. On Earth it was a felony to fly any vehicle without an autopilot. A falling car would be bound to kill someone, no matter where it fell. Here, thousands of miles of wilderness, buildings suspended over cities, and headroom for a guest 50 feet tall. There was a city beneath the castle. It showed no lights. Speaker skimmed over it like a swooping hawk, scanned it hastily in the blue archlight. He came up to report that the city looked very like Zignamuclickclick.
"We can explore it after dawn," he said. "I think this stronghold is more important. It may have been untouched since the fall of civilization."
"It must have its own power source," Louis speculated. "I wonder why. None of the buildings in Zignamuclickclick did." Tila sent her cycle skimming directly under the castle. In the intercom, her eyes went big with wonder, and she cried, "Louis, Speaker, you've got to see this." They dropped after her without thought. Louis was moving up alongside her when he became suddenly, freezingly aware of the mass suspended over his head. There were windows all over the underside, and the underside was all angles. There was no way to land the castle. Who had built it, and how, with no bottom to it? Concrete and metal, asymmetrically designed, and what the tonj was holding it up? Louis's stomach lurched, but he set his jaw and pulled up alongside Tila, underneath a floating mass equivalent to a medium-sized passenger starship. Tila had found a wonder, a sunken swimming pool, bathtub-shaped and brightly lit. Its glass bottom and glass walls were open to the outer darkness, but for one wall which bordered on a bar, or a living room, or... it was hard to tell, looking through 2 thicknesses of transparency.
The pool was dry. In the bottom was a single great skeleton resembling that of a bandersnatch.
They kept large pets, Louis speculated.
Isn't that a Jinxian bandersnatch? My uncle was a hunter, said Teela. He had his trophy room built inside a bandersnatch skeleton.
There are bandersnatchy in a lot of worlds. They were slaver food animals. I wouldn't be surprised to find them all through the galaxy. The question is, what made the Ringworlders bring them here?
Decoration, Teela said promptly.
Are you kidding?
A bandersnatch looked like a cross between Moby Dick and a caterpillar tractor. Still, Louis thought, why not? Why wouldn't the engineers have raided a dozen or 100 stellar systems to populate their artificial world? By hypothesis, they had ram-scoop fusion drives. By necessity, every living thing on the Ringworld had been brought from somewhere else. Sunflowers? Bandersnatchy? What else?
Forget it. Go straight for the rim wall. Don't try to explore. Already they had come far enough to circle the Earth half a dozen times. Finnegal's Law. How much there was to find.
Strange life. Harmless so far. Sunflowers. Speaker, flaming in a glare of light, yowling into the intercom. Floating cities, which fell disastrously.
Bandersnatchy. Intelligent and dangerous. They would be the same here. Bandersnatchy did not mutate.
And death? Death was always the same everywhere.
They circled the castle again, looking for openings. Windows there were, all shapes, rectangles and octagons and bubbles and thick panes in the floor. But all were closed. They found a dock for flying vehicles, with a great door built like a drawbridge to act as a landing ramp. But, like a drawbridge, the door was up and closed. They found a couple of 100 feet of spiral escalator hanging like a bedspring from the lowermost tip of the castle. Its bottom ended in open air. Some force had twisted it away, leaving sheared beams and broken treads. Its top was a locked door.
"To Finnegal with this! I'm going to ram a window," said Teela.
"Stop," Louis commanded. He believed she would do it.
"Speaker, use the disintegrator. Get us in."
In the light streaming from the great picture window, Speaker unslung the slaver digging tool. Louis knew about the disintegrator. Objects within its variable-width beam acquired, suddenly, a positive charge powerful enough to tear them apart. The puppeteers had added a second parallel beam to suppress the charge on the proton. Louis had not used it to dig in the sunflower field, and he knew it would not be needed for this job. He might have guessed that Speaker would use it anyway. 2 points a few inches apart on the great octagonal window acquired opposite charges with a potential difference between. The flash was blinding. Louis clenched his eyes over tears and pain. The crack of thunder was simultaneous and deafening even through the sonic fold. In the stunned calm that followed, Louis felt gritty particles settled thickly over his neck and shoulders and the backs of his hands. He kept his eyes closed.
"You had to test it," he said.
"It works very well. It will serve us."
"Happy birthday. Don't point it at Daddy, because Daddy will be very angry."
"Do not be flippant, Louis."
His eyes had recovered. Louis found millions of tiny glass slivers all over him and the cycle. Flying glass? The sonic fold must have stopped the particles, then released them to drift down over every horizontal surface. Teela was already floating into the ballroom-sized cavity. They followed. Louis woke, gradually, feeling wonderful. He was lying on his arm, on a soft surface. His arm was asleep. He rolled over and opened his eyes. He was in a bed, looking up at a high white ceiling. An obstruction under his ribs turned out to be Teela's foot.
Right. They had found the bed last night. A bed as big as a miniature golf course, in an enormous bedroom in what would have been the basement of a less unusual castle. By then, they had already found marvels. The castle was a castle indeed, and not merely a posh hotel. A banquet hall with a picture window 50 feet tall was startling enough. But the tables circled a central ring-shaped table on a raised dais.
The ring surrounded a contoured, high-backed chair the size of a throne. Teela, experimenting, had found how to make the chair rise halfway to the ceiling, and how to activate a pickup to amplify the voice of the occupant into a thunder of command. The chair would turn, and when it turned, the sculpture above it turned too. The sculpture was in stressed wire, very light, mostly empty space. It had seemed an abstraction until Teela started it turning. Then, it was obviously a portrait. The sculpted head of an entirely hairless man. Was he a native, from a community whose members shaved their faces and scalps? Or had he been a member of another race from far around the curve of the ring? They might never know, but the face was decidedly human, handsome, angular, the face of one used to command. Louis looked up at the ceiling and remembered that face. Command had worn lines into that face, around the eyes and mouth, and the artist had somehow managed to include those lines into the wire framework. This castle had been a seat of government. Everything pointed to it. The throne, the banquet hall, the unique windows, the floating castle itself with its independent power source. But for Louis Wu, the clincher was that face. Afterward, they had wandered through the castle. They had found lavishly decorated, beautifully designed staircases everywhere. But they didn't move. There were no escalators, no elevators, no slidewalks, no drop shafts. Perhaps the stairs themselves had moved once. So the party had wandered downward, because it was easier than climbing up. In the bottom of the castle, they had found the bedroom. Endless days of sleeping in fly-cycle seats, of making love wherever the fleet had happened to touch down, had made that bed irresistible to Teela and Louis Wu. They had left Speaker to continue his explorations alone. By now there was no telling what he had found. Louis raised himself on one elbow. The dead hand was coming back to life. He was careful not to jar it. "Never happens with sleeping plates," he reflected. "But what the tange, at least it's a bed." One glassy wall of the bedroom opened on a dry pool. Framed by glass walls and a glass floor, the white skeleton of a Frumious Bandersnatch looked back at him with empty eyes set in a spoon-shaped skull. The opposite wall, equally transparent, opened 1,000 feet over the city. Louis rolled over 3 times and dropped off the edge of the bed. The floor was soft, covered with a fur rug whose texture and color disturbingly resembled a native's beard. Louis padded to the window and looked out. Something was interfering with his vision, like a minor flicker of a tri-D screen. Consciously, he had not even noticed. Nonetheless, it was annoying. Beneath a white and featureless sky, the city was all the colors of gray. Most of the buildings were tall, but a bare handful were tall enough to dwarf the rest. Taller, a few of them, than the bottom of this floating castle. There had been other floating buildings. Louis could see the scars, broad gaps in the cityscape where thousands of tons of masonry had smashed down. But this one dream castle had had its own independent power supply, and a bedroom big enough to fit any decent-sized orgy. With a tremendous window wall from which a sultan might contemplate his domain, might see his subjects, as the ants they were. "This place must have been conducive to hubris," said Louis Wu. Something caught his eye, something fluttering outside the window. Thread. A length of it had hung up on a cornice, but more of it was still drifting down from the sky. Coarse thread. He could see the 2 strands trailing from the cornice down over the city. It must have been falling for as long as he had been looking out the window, interfering with his vision. Not knowing its origin, Louis accepted it for what it was, something pretty. He lay nude on his back on the hairy wall-to-wall rug, and he watched the thread drifting past his window. He felt safe and rested, perhaps for the first time since an X-ray laser had touched the lyre. The thread drifted endlessly down, loop after loop of black line curving out of a white-gray sky. It was fine enough to flicker in and out of visibility. How to know the length of it? How to count the snowflakes in a blizzard? Suddenly, Louis recognized it. "Welcome back," he said. But he was jolted. Shadow square wire. It had followed them here. Louis climbed 5 flights of stairs to find his breakfast.
Naturally, he didn't expect the kitchen to be operating. He was looking for the banquet hall, but he found the kitchen instead. It confirmed